Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Susanna was on Strictly Come Dancing with Anton.
It's funny, you look up Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And it says, you know, Anton's worst score ever with Susanna Constantine. The only time he got knocked out first was with Susanna Constantine. The lowest score he got in X was with Susanna Constantine. Oh.
This week, Raymond and I popped to West Sussex to visit fashion guru, presenter and writer Susanna Constantine and her two dogs Fern, a Parson Russell Terrier, and Rocco, an Italian Greyhound. Susanna is widely known for her TV partnership with Trini Woodall, but she had the most extraordinary life before that, kind of as an original It girl and royal girlfriend when she dated Princess Margaret's son, David Linley. She's endlessly fascinating and hilarious, and she's also written a brilliant memoir called Ready for Absolutely Nothing, which I couldn't put down. It's totally unfiltered and just bursting with incredible anecdotes, a bit like her, really. Susanna took a while to warm to Raymond, I'm not going to lie, but by the end, she was cuddling him and she called him one of the few small dogs I can actually tolerate. I think it might be the greatest compliment he's ever had. I'm going to stop talking now and hand over to the fabulous woman herself. Here's Susanna and Fern and Rocco and Raymond.
Gotta go, Sharon. Sorry. Come on, Rocky. Where's Rocco? Rocco? Come on. Okay.
Shall we go?
Right.
Come on, you. Oh, Susanna, I've got a good vibe about these dogs getting on.
Yeah, I think they're fine, don't you?
I think they're quite sort of old school gents, your dogs.
Yeah, they're kind of, but it's funny because they're not so used to meeting other dogs. I mean, look at them. I mean, they are, collectively, those three dogs are the most ridiculous things I've ever seen. Raymond, Rocco and Fern. I mean, Raymond is a floor mop.
I think he's found his people.
No, he's ridiculous. Look at him. Funniest thing, some Brillo pad on legs.
And you know, normally he goes on these walks with these big Labradors taking giant strides. Oh. Whereas what I love about your dogs is they're not going to be doing that.
Where's Penny? Pilford! Where is she?
There.
Oh, there you are. Good girl. Oh, you're a good girl. You are.
Oh, it's beautiful here, Susanna.
I know. It really is so lovely. And God, I could never, ever live in London again.
Really?
No. I just find it so, oh no, is he doing a little poo? Good boy.
Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
Come on, Ray.
Yeah, I love going to London, but the only reason I really love going to London is because I get so excited about coming back home again.
We're in Sussex, and I should tell you who I'm with. I'm with the very wonderful Susanna Constantine. I could talk to you for about 10 hours about your absolutely brilliant book.
Thank you. Ready for Absolutely Nothing, which I was.
Ready for Absolutely Nothing. It's a memoir. It's so brilliantly written. It's so funny. First, Susanna, can you introduce us formally to your two fabulous dogs?
Okay, well, we have Rocco, who has one brain cell and is supposedly an Italian Greyhound, which we didn't even know what that was, but he was born at the right time and close by, and he's my youngest daughter Cece's dog. And he's black with little white paws, really kind of, he looks like he's got a thyroid problem because he's got sort of sticky out eyes. And then we have Fern, who is a Parsons Jack Russell. Come on, Raymond. Come on, you little git. Go on. Go on, Fern, show him the way. Yeah, and Fern is my son Joe's dog. And we had two labs, but they're God's dogs now, sadly. So it's just these two. But I've always had a dog. Never in my life have I not had a dog.
Let's go back to your childhood and talk me through your pets, your dogs when you were growing up.
Yeah, the first dog we had was a Yorkshire Terrier called Kimmy, who actually looked a bit like Raymond, funny enough. He was very hairy. And he was kind of like my protector, although he could never be any use at all. But in those days, we had a house in London, and I'd be put out in the front garden, unattended, except for Kimmy in my pram, who looked out for me. So he was the first one, and then Kimmy sadly died. Then we have Mumphy, who was a Maltese Terrier. Oh, shut your mouth. We had a Maltese Terrier called Mumphy, who was very clever and very scruffy. And then I got Piglet, who was a Dachshund. Oi, fuck, Rocco! He gets completely overexcited. Rocco!
Raymond, come here. Come on.
Or is he posing? What's he doing? Raymond, come on. Here. Come on, little man.
So we were talking about
you. Yeah, then I had Piglet. And then I got from Battersea Dogs Home, got a dog called Archie, who was, I think we all have, dog lovers have one dog that stands out, and you'll never repeat that relationship. And that was with Archie, who was half corgi, half lurcher. And he was beautiful, but he was the cleverest dog. And, you know, like so many dogs can be, he was telepathic. You know, he knew what I was feeling, but he would always find me wherever I was. So I remember when we were living in London, we lived in Battersea. Trini and I had just moved offices, so he'd always came with me everywhere. He didn't come to work that day. And he would let himself go I'd just open the door and he'd take himself for a walk in Battersea Park. He'd wait at the zebra crossing for cars to stop, and then he'd cross the zebra crossing on his own and go into the park. We had a mother's help at the time because I was working so much. And she'd taken him for a walk and he disappeared. She called me up in such a panic saying, Archie, I don't know where he is. I can't find him. Anyway, Trini and I were in our new office in Notting Hill, and I went out to go and get a sandwich. And there was Archie sitting on the doorstep. He'd never been there before, but he'd found his way across London. I don't know his route. Across the park and found his way to me. I mean, isn't that just unbelievable?
Oh, and that's so lovely.
He was an amazing dog, and everyone remembers. Archie came to concerts with me. He never needed a lead. He'd come on the tube with me, down the escalators, just sit at my feet on the tube, lay outside. Every time, you know, we had a child, he'd wait out, he'd sleep outside their door and protect them.
Aww.
He was such a great dog. And then...
Yeah, because they become like witnesses to every moment of your life.
So true.
Don't they?
And so true.
They're silent witnesses.
Yeah.
You know, I said things in front of a dog I wouldn't even say in front of a partner, like, or talk to myself.
Yeah.
You know, it is a really intimate relationship.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's very... I could never not have a dog. But he was really special. And these two are lovely, but I don't have that. I want to find another rescue dog. And I remember a friend of mine said, when you go to Battersea, just look for a dog that's sitting quietly. And that's what I did with Archie. He was just sitting quietly. And it was love at first sight.
So I want to go back to your childhood, because to the outside world it would seem like an incredibly, extraordinarily privileged childhood, but I get the sense that it wasn't without its problems.
I mean, it was an incredibly privileged childhood. You know, I grew up in a very privileged environment. That's just how it was. But because my family life, or my mother, was severely bipolar, I never really knew what was going to happen day by day. Mm-hmm. And we were quite isolated. I had one friend at the time, and I was very shy. So my main relationships growing up were with my animals. So it was with a dog, it was with Kimmy, and then my pony Dandy. And they were enough. They were more reliable, more constant, and would listen without judgment. And it sounds ridiculous, but that's how it was. And they gave me a purpose in life, you know, looking after them, putting their needs before my own.
Your parents were, they weren't aristocracy, but they were very...
They were upper middle class.
Yeah.
My father would like to have been part of the aristocracy. But it was a very old family. Both of them came from very old families, but there was no title or anything. You know, my dad was part of the mercantile classes, really. So there was lots of money around. But they were never, weirdly, my parents were never kind of extravagant.
Mm.
They got what they needed, and then my dad was an amazing collector of antiques and paintings, and he had an incredible eye. He was a real aesthetic. So that's where his money went. He was like a shopaholic of antiques, but everything was incredibly comfortable. It was always quality, not quantity, with him. But we were very, very, very lucky to have, you know, grown up in the environment we did.
And you lived most of the time, as a lot of people of your class and circle really did then, you had your country place and then you'd spend the week in London, really.
Yeah.
And that was in South Kensington. You had...
Yeah, in Pelham Place, like a little Regency, white stucco Regency house, which we considered to be quite modest, but you know, today you look at it and you think, fucking hell, that was such a place.
Yeah.
So we were there during the week, and then every weekend we go up to Lincolnshire, and holidays and half terms would all be Lincolnshire, and that for me was home. You know, the weeks were, you just sort of had to get through. I had to get through before going back home to the Priory in Lincolnshire.
That was connected to the Duke and Duchess of Rutland, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We didn't own it. We rented it off the estate, but lived there for 45 years. We rented it for 45 years. And the reason it was such a home was because we had this incredible housekeeper, Mrs. A. Mrs. A is my mother. You know, she died sadly last year, but I thought, and it's a terrible thing to say, but it's the truth. She was my mum. And, you know, I love my own mother, my biological mother, but Mrs. A was constant. She was always there. She was so wise, so level-headed, the most amazing cook. She never went away.
I get the impression there was almost a sense of you being slightly handed over by your parents.
My parents not only pay people to look after my sister and I, but also to love us. And, you know, if we were bathed and watered and fed and receive love, they were happy, and that gave them the freedom to go and do whatever they wanted. But I think, you know, that was very, very, it suited my father perfectly, but my mother found that very difficult.
Did she?
Yeah, because she, you know, she was so maternal, but my father was quite controlling, and she had to toe the line with him. So, but I think she found it very difficult being away from her daughters, very difficult.
I suppose it was, you know, a classic patriarchal setup due to the time and all that kind of stuff. But I suppose when you add status and money into it, you get to make even more decisions and so throw your weight around even more.
Mm.
I always feel a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, because you don't need to rely on anyone else. You know, in my relationship, my marriage, I have to give as much as my husband gives. You know, this is a partnership. I'm not going to, and my husband doesn't expect me to just be a housewife. He expects me to work.
Yeah, that's really interesting about your dad, that I can sort of see how the money and the privilege almost isolated your mother further.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, Emily, but you're right.
Because that's what money buys you.
Yeah.
Is seclusion and a cloistered life.
Yeah. It buys you the ability to be completely and utterly selfish. That's what it does. My father, as much as I loved him, as much as I respected him, he was unbelievably selfish. You know, it was all about him and his needs, and he came first, always. And he had the, you know, the finance to be able to implement that.
And was your mum, was she a kind of society beauty, as they would have
been
called
then? Yeah, she was. I mean, she wasn't a society beauty. She was definitely a beauty. You know, my father loved beautiful things. And she was his greatest acquisition. And he, you know, he kind of shone in her reflected beauty, if you like. And he was, he needed her. You know, he wasn't someone who was comfortable on his own. He needed her by his side so he then could shine, which is kind of the two kind of contradict each other. You know, here's a man who's incredibly selfish, living his own life, doing what he wants, but he couldn't do it on his own. And so he, you know, when mum got really ill and her bipolar disorder started to manifest itself, he was completely, well, he was in denial that it was affecting her, but he was obsessed with her illness. And he was also a terrible hypochondriac, so he'd read up on it. But he, it's almost like he was reading up on it as a topic that had no bearing on him whatsoever.
Sort of intellectualising almost, yeah.
Yeah.
And when you grow up with a parent who suffers from mental illness, particularly when it's undiagnosed, it makes you quite hypervigilant and keen to control the environment for the parent, perhaps, where you're nothing. I need to make sure nothing.
Yeah, you see, I never felt that. And I think that's because I had a sister who was 6 years older than me, and we had Mrs. A. So I was kind of relinquished of that responsibility. But I was a watcher. And so I was always watching what my mum was doing. And I think that's why I found it so difficult being sent, well, I know it's why I found it so difficult being sent to boarding school, because I was unable to monitor. And I was doing the monitoring completely subconsciously. I didn't realise I was doing it.
And what sort of, what in terms of just how she would be or her behaviour or what mood
well,
she was in?
Well, it depended if she was on a high or a low. You know, if she was on a low, she'd just sit and that was it. Just sit. Nothing. You know, it was like no one was home at all. And when she was on a high, she would speak so fast, because her brain was motoring at 1,000 miles an hour. Her speech couldn't keep up. And then she'd write and it would be just complete scribbles, because again, her brain was going so fast. And she was literally manic, and then became psychotic, and there were helicopters landing on the roof and fuck knows what else. You know, and I choose to look at the positives that my
mother's illness gave me, and my mother. So she was someone who treated everybody the same, had respect for everybody. You know, she was as good friends with the butcher, with our local butcher, Mr. Taylor, as she was with the Duke and Duchess of Rutland. You know, they would come in, have tea, she'd get everyone together. And, you know, that was the greatest gift that she could have given me and my sister. And also, it was the ability to live in the present, which, because I've never been someone who looks back, and I've never looked forward to the point of irresponsibility, really, but just living in the moment. Because as a child, that's all I had. I didn't know what the next day was going to bring. I had no fucking idea how she was going to be, whether we'd be going to hospital to see her, whether we'd be pulling her out of a smoking bed, whether she'd be catatonic or manic. And so all, because my sister was away, she'd gone to boarding school and then she went to New York, so I was a bit like an only child. So all I had was the moment I was in. And, you know, that's a great way to live your life, is right now, right here, me walking with you. Well, Raymond's sort of lazy little fuck and being carried. But this is not a dog walk, is it really, for Raymond? We've got the dog, but we don't have the walk. The dog walk.
He's just not cooperating today.
There we go.
Oh, no, look, he's walking now. He responds to Susanna because she gives him boundaries.
No, it's because you're going downhill. Oh, yeah. That's all it is.
And so, obviously, as you say, you went to boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
And when you emerged from boarding school, I was really fascinated the way you were writing about how there was really just one path for you, wasn't there? As far as the world you came from, your job was to find a good husband.
Yeah. No, that was the case. And I remember, you know, I left school and I could have gone to university, but my dad said to me, oh, darling, you know, that's a lovely idea, but you'd be far better off learning how to make good beef Wellington than going to university. That summed up my upbringing. We were, you know, and all the girls who were at St Mary's Wantage, which was the shittest school in the world, we were all the same. We were being prepared to step into our mother's shoes. And I, fucking hell, I did not want that. So my rebellion wasn't sex, drugs and rock and roll. Though a lot of my friends, it was, in particular, drugs, heroin. I chose to work. That was my, you know, that was my rebellion, to go off and make my own money.
And you went to this, you did a cordon bleu cookery course in...
Hilarious, yeah.
Well, there were like three choices, weren't there? You could go to finishing school...
Finishing school, secretarial college or cookery school.
Mm.
And...
I think you chose the best option.
I think I did. I mean, I know how to make a croissant from scratch, can you believe it?
Damn useful.
And it takes fucking hours. But I really enjoyed that, because again it was that purpose, and it was being, you know, it was a very, very professional school where, you know, they were all men, young men who were training to become professional chefs, and it was just, you know, it was such a great setting to be in, where you're, you know, we'd work as teams, and I love, you know, food is the most important thing in my life.
And but so you came back, and then you were living at your parents' and you had this dinner party. Well, talk me through the story of how you ended up meeting the Queen's nephew, David Linley, who you dated for 5 years.
Yeah, well, I was at school with Edwina Hicks, who is Pamela Hicks, who's the daughter of Mountbatten. Lord Mountbatten, and David Hicks is the interior designer, and Edwina, who's very sadly bipolar as well, she was, you know, one of my best friends, and we were having dinner, and I was having a dinner party, which is ridiculous, you know, at the age of whatever I was, 20, 21, in my parents' very grand dining room.
And you were still living at home?
I was still living at home, and she said, oh, I want to bring a friend. And I said, yeah, sure. And David turned up. And I fancied someone else, but he was a heroin addict, sadly. So he had no interest in me whatsoever. He was just waiting to get into the loo for his next fix to shoot up. And I just found David so easy to talk to and different. And for me, it was always like finding a different path, subconsciously finding a way out, towing the line, but always looking for that tributary that went away from, you know, the main course. And he was that, you know, because he was had his own business, he was highly creative, he dressed differently, he had, you know, he was more, not worldly, but he just had a different outlook on life. And I found that really appealing, and we just got on. There was a commonality there.
And was it a slow burn, or...?
It was quite a slow burn. I would say it was about a two-week burn. And I was known as concrete knickers, not because they fell down easily, but because no one could get into them. So 2 weeks was quite quick, actually, for me. And we had our first kiss on top of a Ferris wheel at a little village fete in Oxfordshire. Yeah, and we kind of grew up together in, you know, many ways.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I love the relationship you had with his mother.
Yeah.
Princess Margaret, because she just seems a brilliant laugh.
Well, she was a brilliant laugh, but she was also, she loved to have a good time, but she was also tremendously warm, loyal and kind. Mm. And she, like Mrs. A, she made me feel safe. You know, I felt safe in her company. And there was, you know, and she was so unjudgmental. The only people she hated were sycophants. You know, I was just so lucky to have had her in my life and to have got to know her so well, and vice versa. And she, you know, my parents met her. We had a dinner at Kensington Palace, and my mum was on such a raging high. And she was, every time Princess Margaret turned to look at her, my mum would curtsy. I mean, she was like this every, like not even 5 seconds, but every millisecond she was curtsying, and I was dying inside. But Princess Margaret totally ignored that. Mm. And it was the first time I saw another adult treat my mum like she didn't have an illness, not to be patronising or pitying or rolling their eyes. Mm. She was, you know, she knew exactly how to handle it, and I was so grateful. You know, it was the first, and it gave me a new respect for my mother, weirdly. I'm just thinking about that now, but I think it did. It's like, yeah, it's not my mother that's presenting itself, it's her illness. My mother is still there somewhere. Yes. And that's who Princess Margaret was relating to.
When people criticise her, the criticisms tend to, which I find fascinating, revolve around her being caustic or acerbic. And you think, isn't it interesting that the Duke of Edinburgh is sort of celebrated for that?
Yeah.
There are books called The Acerbic Wit of the Duke of Edinburgh, whereas that wasn't her role, which is why I think it's criticised. How dare she have agency and take up space, basically, as a woman.
But she was just protecting herself, and she didn't suffer fools. And, you know, the wankers that have that opinion of her saw one side of her, and they deserve to see that side of her, in my humble opinion. It's like the Queen was, you know, she was giving service to her, the crown and country, and Princess Margaret gave service to her sister. And yes, she had the freedom to carve out, you know, her own life in hidden corners. But she too had a responsibility, and that was to Her Majesty the Queen.
Princess Margaret not only comes over as sort of, as you say, a nice, warm, slightly maternal figure for you.
Oh, totally maternal, yeah.
But there's also the sense of her being very just get on with it, no nonsense.
Oh, she was so practical, and she was not fazed or embarrassed by anything.
Mm.
Another reason I loved her, and I have, that's something I learnt to try not to be. Oh, Rocco, shut your mouth. And anyway, we were going round every summer. She would organise these kind of tours around a famous,
hello,
a famous London landmark. And we were at Greenwich. And I, after kind of in the middle of lunch, I really needed to go and do a poo. So I went and did a poo. It was quite big. It wouldn't flush. I was thinking, what the fuck am I going to do? All these people, go away. All these people, you know, they're going to come in and they're going to know it's me because I've been away from the table for so long. But Princess Margaret, God bless her, came to find me, and I was still kind of sitting on the loo, thinking with my pants around my ankles, thinking, what am I going to do with this poo? And she kind of said, you know, it's like, darling, just go and get a knife. And you'll have to read the book to find out what happened and how she dealt with the drain blocking poo. And so she was there, and then again in Mustique I passed out and pooed myself, and she was there to mop up the pieces for that too. No nonsense, just get on with it. Oh dear, poor Susanna, she's shat herself. And then her backup was Jerry Hall, so that wasn't such a great moment.
You and David obviously didn't end up marrying, and I get the sense that you were, well, you were very honest about this, that you were basically waiting for him to commit at that point.
I was, and he wouldn't, so I ran away to New York thinking he's going to miss me and then I'm going to come back, he's going to ask me to marry him. And he didn't. And so it kind of fizzled out.
Is it hard breaking up with someone like that?
Well, I think it's hard for anyone. You know, your first love. I mean, it was a kind of like a love affair with L plates. It's like you're learning how to have a relationship with someone.
But I suppose
it is very hard because it's like, you know, you've left home, you've flown the nest. You know, I've flown the nest, finally, you know. And it's like you adopt your boyfriend's family.
I know, but so what about when it's the royal family?
Well, to me, I mean, genuinely, she was just my boyfriend's mother. That completely came from her. That's what was hard. And it was, you know, you get into a routine and we go away for weekends and they would come up to the Priory, or we go to Royal Lodge, and so all that goes, and it doesn't matter who you're going out with, that goes. And I think that's as hard as splitting up with a boyfriend. You know, it's kind of everything else that comes with your boyfriend, their family, their friends, their, you know, home, their everything.
I think in some ways for a lot of people, if that relationship broke up, they'd feel, oh my God, all my life's kind of ended because I subsumed myself into that person's life. But I feel you were always very much your own person still.
Yeah, I think I've always been that.
Mm.
And I didn't realise at the time. But I think I always have been. I think I'm someone who's very happy on their own.
Are you?
I don't need people at all. In fact, I find it hard to be surrounded by a lot of people, unless it's work related.
Yeah.
I'd much rather, my absolute happy state is solitude, isolation,
and being completely alone. So I think maybe that's why. I don't know.
And you obviously met your husband.
Mm-hmm.
You had a really kind of love at first sight thing with him, really, didn't you, when you met him at a party?
It was such a fucking cliche. You know, it really was love at first sight. And, you know, I've had that with other people, not just... I mean, the person I had it with before Steve was Jake Shears from the Scissor Sisters, a raging homosexual that he is. But I fell in love with him. You know, there's no other way of looking at it. I knew I was never going to fuck him, but I fell in love with him. And I felt the same with Steen. I fell, it was instant, but it was more than, you know, I just, you know, you know, I knew he was going to be my husband. And then we started talking at this party, and 3 hours in, he mentioned his father, Peter Bertelsen. I was like, you're shitting me. And I'd worked for his father for 4 or 5 years. 8 years previously, because Peter had backed Alistair Blair, designer, and John Galliano, Richard James, Patrick Cox, Catherine Hamnett. And I'd worked for his dad, so I knew his dad really well, and his mum. So it was in the stars, and he was just the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. But just so solid, again, just... his himself. He wasn't impressed by anything, Steen. Mm. Nothing.
And you were, I suppose, quite a lot to take on. Not, I don't mean that, please, don't think I mean that in the, oh.
Oh, no, I don't take I just it mean like that at all.
You were a lot to take on.
Well,
in
I had a bit
you
of
were
a
well
history,
known,
yeah.
And you had a profile, and everyone knew who you were. And
well, he was really embarrassed by that, Steen. You know, he was working for Hill Samuel at the time, and he did not tell anyone. He did not. We
you
would go to a party
secret.
And he'd come, you know, he'd never go to a party with me in the beginning because he was too embarrassed to turn up with me. So he'd come half an hour later and we'd meet there because he didn't want to be seen with me because he didn't want to be have the label of going up with some kind of socialite twat.
We should say career-wise as well. You'd been working for Alistair Blair, this designer. You'd gone into fashion, hadn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I'd gone into, not into fashion, I mean, it just happened to be fashion, but
the
I'd
fashion
gone
industry,
into
yeah.
fashion to get a job, and my job at the time was literally, you know, Girl Friday.
And well, now you'd be an grew. Influencer. Now it would
but
be.
But that's a... so exactly yeah. right.
If you'd it be was paid today, a fortune as
you know,
a brand
Peter
ambassador.
Was smart enough to see, here's a girl who'd never had a fucking job, had no education, but she had a good address book and she was known in the newspapers. And I was the right person for Alistair. Most people probably, you know, I had no experience.
And tall.
And my father-in-law just, and he, Peter Bertelsen, Danish, he, more than anyone, changed my life.
Oh, how lovely.
Because he gave me an opportunity to work. He gave me purpose. If I hadn't, you know, he employed me, and if I hadn't been good at the job, he would have fired me. But I wasn't. I was good at it, and I worked bloody hard. Mm. And because of that, everything went on. You know, that was the start of my career. That was the start of me being independent. That was the start of me getting away from my family. That was the start of me appreciating the value of family through him, not my own family.
Mm.
And, you know, I have so much to thank him for, and I wish he was still around. He was an amazing, amazing, larger-than-life, difficult man, but just amazing. So, yeah, thanks, OPB.
And then your career obviously massively took off in your sort of 30s and 40s, really?
Yeah, we were like... It was just off. I got married at 32, and it was. I remember Steen saying to me when we got engaged, she said, "Don't think for one minute you're going to be relying on me for money. You've got to go out and work." And that was red rag to bull. And I thought, okay, you fucking watch me, you. And I did. and it was just everything.
But that's why you married the right person.
I did marry.
And that, you know what?
Yeah.
If someone had said that to your mother, I know she had mental illness, yeah. So I'm not saying, oh, yeah. She would have been fine. But what she was also lacking was purpose.
Exactly.
And isn't it amazing how, you know, I know you've suffered from anxiety and we've, you know, people yeah. go through things, but sometimes it is helpful to have that focus.
Totally. And, you know, I can't, he's the last person I can take any criticism from, but he's the only person I'll listen to. Because I trust him and he's always annoyingly right.
And when your career took off with Trini, mm-hmm. watching your career and the success of What Not to Wear and all the other stuff you did and the books and the other shows, and I suspect inside there was, you were probably feeling, there's probably still a sense of imposter syndrome, and you know.
Well, do you know what? There never was, actually. There never was imposter syndrome. It was, it just sort of happened.
Did you did you never have imposter syndrome?
No, I think looking back, don't get me wrong, I'm so grateful to have had the career I did. But for absolute certain sure, I could never have done it without Trini. But everything kind of just sort of happened. It didn't, we didn't manufacture anything. It just sort of was on its own trajectory. And it was just a job. It was just a job. I wasn't aware of the success we were having or the impact. And because I don't look back, I still don't think that at all. It was a job. It was, you know, we were making really good money. And for me, the most important thing was that we were helping women and making women feel better about themselves. Mm. And that I never felt imposterish about. You know, that was something really valuable, and it gave me a huge amount of self-worth to be able to help other people.
How did you feel about fame?
I didn't feel anything. I hate, you know, being on television is, for me, I mean, it was hard to begin with live TV. It's like, you know, absolute terror, but then you get used to it, and it was just being yourself, it was just doing your thing on television. It was just, the focus wasn't on the camera, the focus was on the woman or man that you were helping. I didn't even think about the cameras. And then, you know, fame, I didn't think about fame either. You know, I didn't sort of seek out fame. You know, it's very easy to be well known and avoid all that shit. It's very easy. You just don't buy into it. You just get on with your life. You don't go to walk down every red carpet, which is the most ridiculous thing to do. And you know, we knew who we were, so we were able to handle it. You know, if it had happened to us when we were in our, you know, early 20s, I'm sure it would have been a very different story. But even, you know, we're talking whatever it is, 15, 20 years ago, and the kind of media was so different then. It was less immediate. It was more, you were able to have some sort of control over it. You know, Trini was very much the more memorable one. And she, you know, I could sort of stand behind her. I'm not good at being the front runner in anything except for writing. You know, I don't want to be the one making decisions. I don't want to be the one in the spotlight. I want to be, you know, I'll take spotlight, but as long as I've got part of me covered by someone else. And Trini provided that. You know, she was much more comfortable with it than I was.
It's interesting as well that, obviously, looking at some of the incredible photos, and I mean, for that alone,
aren't they brilliant? They're just snapshots, most of them.
Susanna's snapshots. Oh, that was one that, I had that, and Litchfield took that of me. But what's interesting is, obviously, you look like a model in those pictures. Did you consider yourself beautiful?
No.
Did you think of yourself?
I just thought, you know, I was kind of average. I mean, I really, really didn't think anything of myself particularly. But I do look back now at those pictures and I can appreciate that,
you know, I looked pretty okay. And it kind of, and then I look at my daughter Esme, who's my eldest daughter, she's the spit of me. And I look at her and I go, fucking hell, you're gorgeous. And then I think, oh, actually, you'd look like me. Mm. So that's a bit of a surprise. But no, I never felt I was anything particularly...
I think in a way, though, it's that weird thing, isn't it? That you start to get confidence and you start to love yourself a bit more, frankly, in middle age.
Yeah, and I think you've just got to be aware of your flaws, your defects. And
what are your flaws?
I'm codependent, I'm a people pleaser, and I can be passive aggressive. So those are mine. There you go. And
are you working on the people pleasing? How do you work on it? Because do you have therapy?
No, I'm not going to. No, I have in the past. Mm. No, I'm not going to stop being a people pleaser. You know, I can't. It's much more important to me. You know, I will be friends with someone if I think they like me. It doesn't matter what I think of them. But if I think they like me, then I'll be friends with them. So that's, I don't know if that's kind of massively egotistical.
If someone gives me even a chip, if there's an inkling
that
they disapprove in some way, or...
How can you be friends with someone like that? Unless you want to win them over. I mean, I had that with Jake Shears. You know, I think he wasn't, you know, who the fuck I was, anything about that. But I was determined to make him like me, and not only to like me, but to like me best in the world. And I did it. I mean, he probably doesn't like me best in the world, but we are very, very close friends.
I
worked at that, you know, hard. It's funny, Emily. But isn't it funny? I can't be like this in my family.
Why? What do you mean, like this?
I don't know why. Like, kind of completely open. It's like I'm God, and I'm just thinking this now. This is not something that's in the book or anything, but it's kind of almost like I don't think my children will accept who I really am. I don't know. Isn't that, that's a weird thing to say, but it's... I find it easier to be myself with other people. I find it quite hard to be totally myself with my children, because I think they'll be embarrassed of me, or, you know, they'll inwardly be going, oh, for fuck's sake, Mum. Or, I mean, I know they love me, and I know, you know, I had this thing where I called up this, it was this kind of, I don't know what you call them, not fortune teller, and she's this incredible woman in America, and Trini told me about her. And she sort of helps hospitals, and you know, surgeons will call her up and they'll, you know, say, should I work on this person? Will it be okay? So she's really got a gift. I thought, okay, I'm going to go for it. And the first thing she said to me, and the only thing I remember, was, oh my God, you're a phenomenal mum, aren't you? And that was the best thing anyone has ever said to me. And I do think I'm a good mum. I know, and that's what, you know... A lot of mums say that, and I know I'm a good mum. I'm there for my kids, but I people please with my children too.
But can you not? I can see why that is, because if I had grown up in your environment with a mother that I was frightened of upsetting, or I couldn't rely on, or I didn't feel stability from, if I had gone on to have kids, my entire life would be dedicated to never making them feel unsafe.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting.
You don't want your kids to ever ever experience the feelings you experienced, which is mum's vulnerable.
But I tell them that, though. I tell them, you know, I will tell them. And, like, you know, when I went public about being an alcoholic, well, they knew I was an alcoholic, and, you know, that was really tough for them, especially my youngest daughter. And that was actually the hardest bit to write in the book. I didn't... You know, that really did affect me, writing about Cece and her being my watcher.
It's your daughter, yeah.
Yeah, and I feel, you know, tremendous guilt about that. But we talk about it, and I just said, look, Cece, you know, the only way I can make amends is by staying sober. But one thing I will say is that everyone in life goes through trauma, unfortunately, at some point in their lives. You've been through it earlier, and it's what you went through with having a mum who's an alcoholic
is going to help you in later life, you know, and what I've learnt in recovery, I can pass on to you, and you can help, and, you know, it can help you in your daily life. It can help you to accept the things you can't change and to not worry about tomorrow because you might get run over by a bus. So what's the point of worrying about it? And so, you know, but I do feel tremendous, tremendous guilt still about that, but I can't change it, so I just need to...
Did you have a moment of clarity when you thought this is enough?
Yes, I did. We were in Cornwall and with Steen's family and our family, his like, parents and Australian cousins and stuff. We all got shit-faced, but because I was like a sponge that was already saturated, it affected me much more quickly. And I blacked out, fell, broke two transverse processes in my back, pissed myself. I was with my children, and Steen and my brother-in-law, Pierre, took me to bed. And I was in such pain physically because of my back, emotionally broken.
Mm.
And so the next day I got up and I got everyone around the kitchen table and I said, I need help, I'm an alcoholic and I've been lying to you, I've been drinking secretly, I drink three times as much as any of you think. And then I asked them all how it had been affecting them. I said, I need to hear the truth. So they told me. And then came back home and went to an AA meeting the next day, and it was, that was like coming home. Not feel, you know, first time in years I didn't feel alone. It was the first time I was honest about something in years.
How long has it been then since you've had a drink? Come on.
Well, I've been going to AA for just over 10 years and I had two relapses, which were fucking amazing. But I haven't picked up a drink for 7 years.
And so you've been writing, obviously you've written this book, but it's not your first book because
I read loads with Trini and she sort of produced them and I wrote them. And then I've written, you know, I've written many articles.
And you guys stayed...
We're really,
really
close friends.
Close friends, which is lovely.
Yeah.
It doesn't often happen after professional partnerships end like that.
No, but we're very, 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 very close. We don't see each other so much because she's so busy with her business and has done so phenomenally well. And I couldn't be more proud of her, but I never expected anything less of her.
Were you sad when that ended?
I was sad.
Were you?
We both were. It was very hard for us. And we'd still, you know, for many years afterwards, well, not as many years, but quite a few years afterwards, you know, one or other of us, Trini more than me, but would get recognised. And it'd be, oh, look, there's Trini and Susanna when we weren't together. You know, it was never just Susanna or just Trini. But our friendship, it runs very, very, very deep. She's such a loyal person, Trin.
Yeah.
She's so loyal, and I know she would drop everything, and I would do the same for her.
What do you think, Susanna, your friends would say are like your best qualities?
Such an interesting question. I've never thought about it. I think that down to earth and funny and loving, probably. That's what I'd like to hear.
What would you worry, they would say? What would you least like to hear?
I'm lazy, although I'm not. But I have a chip on my shoulder about being lazy.
Do you? Is that from your family, do you think?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Not, I don't know where that's come from. No, I think that's self-flagellation.
Oh, look, mushroom.
Magic mushroom.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's a big one.
Is that a magic mushroom?
Yeah. I bet. I'm sure you know. Microdosing over here. I've never taken them. Too scared of my dark side.
I've never taken them either. I'm terrified of anything like hallucinogenic.
Yeah, me too. Petrified. I tell you what I do worry about now.
From?
Is that I'm antisocial. We never get to see her. And I worry about not being a good enough friend.
That's what I worry about.
But then I think the right friendships survive that.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Don't they?
Yeah, totally. And I love meeting new people as well, because it's sort of like you start all over again, and then you know, once you've known someone for a long time, there's that kind of transition where you have to make, you know, at the first it's exciting and, you know, and then it gets a bit boring and you have to make an effort, and then it becomes like an old pair of slippers and it doesn't matter.
I feel like you've really sort of, you're at peace with your folks now, because they're no longer with us, obviously, but
no,
I feel like you've got some closure.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know if I, you know, when they died, both my parents, I didn't cry a single tear.
Did you not? Do you cry often?
Never.
Why not?
I don't know. I cry happy tears, but I do not cry. And it's, I think, you know, I need to cry, but I think there's so much buried. It would be good to cry, but I don't. I try and make myself cry and squeeze the tears out, but I just can't cry.
But then you've obviously, there's that line in The Talented Mr. Ripley, and I'm not comparing you, by the way, to... him, but he talks about there's that dark basement.
Yes.
And you meet someone and you finally think, I might let you in.
Yeah.
I feel like you let your husband in, and maybe he was the first person.
You know what? I don't think I have completely. I don't think I've even let myself in, into myself. I haven't let him in, but he's found his way in. And that's why he's such a good man. That's why I'm so lucky. And that's why, you know, 27 years we're still together.
And I can imagine, you know, there's a really interesting thing you mentioned in the book when you're dating Imran Khan.
Yeah.
Because of course that's what you do when you've broken up with the Queen's nephew, you go out with Imran Khan.
Yeah, of course.
But you said you never, you were in that relationship always aware that you were the lover rather than the loved.
You know, I think writing this book, I realised, and looking back at all the photographs and the times we had, I realised we did actually have much more of a relationship than I remember.
Mm.
And, you know, it's one of those sort of tropes that we teach ourselves to say, and so you can, you know, you can compartmentalise a relationship in one sentence and then that's it, you don't need to go any further. But, I was always aware that it was never going to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I did protect myself with him. And I remember he wrote me a letter. And he said, you know, the thing is, you never let me in.
Come on, you. Oh, what a lovely, lovely walk it's been with you,
good.
Susanna.
And I'm sorry that... Raymond has been
such
a lazy sod.
He's a pampered London prince.
Oh, you're just very sweet, though. I'm glad my daughters aren't here, because they go, oh, can we get Raymond? Can we get a Raymond?
He wouldn't last 5 minutes out here. He'd eat the magic mushrooms.
But do you know what? He would last, because he'd get used to it immediately. He would be running with me. Yeah. I mean, these dogs come running with me. The cats come running with me. So they think they're dogs.
It would be his equivalent of SAS, Are You Tough Enough?
Yeah.
It'll be like one of the... we need to discuss Strictly, because you do mention that in the book. And Susanna was on Strictly Come Dancing with Anton. Was your motivation for doing it... why the hell not?
My motivation... I'm a celebrity too, which I got kicked out first, but I got paid so much money for that I literally did it for the money. And poor ITV, I got kicked off first. And Strictly I did because I had paperback of my first novel coming out. So it was very calculated, and I'd never watched Strictly in my life before. And I thought, fuck it, and I was flattered to be asked, and it was a bit of a... Nothing was going on. I thought, okay, let's do it. Oh my God. It was the most humiliating experience of my life. It was just the most terrifying, the most humiliating, the most rock bottom.
Was it?
period of my life. But I just loved Anton. I loved all the professional dancers, are the nicest, most encouraging, sweetest people. And with the other contestants, I made some really, you know, lifelong friends. And it was incredible to see this whole machine. You know, it was like a kind of fallow garden that was watered, and the whole thing came to life. And I, you know, I wish I had watched it, because I wouldn't have, I would have seen what a privilege it was to have been a part of that. And not to take myself so fucking seriously, which I did. Like, well, if I'm not going to win, I'm going to hate it. And as I couldn't dance, and I looked like a cross between an ironing board and a gorilla, it wasn't going to happen. Poor Anton. It's funny, you look up Wikipedia, and it says, you know, all it says, yeah, Anton's worst score ever with Susanna Constantine. The only time he got knocked out first was with Susanna Constantine. The lowest score he got in X was with Susanna Constantine. I mean, what an extraordinary guy to go through that humiliation forced upon him by me. It was agony. It was like stepping onto the guillotine. You know, the platform of the guillotine, and allowing yourself to be executed willingly. Oh, I mean, look, watching that back, I had to watch it back, and I kind of spontaneously, my bowels liquefied immediately watching it. Oh my God, I think I got PTSD after it, to be honest.
No, I think you can get that from experiences like that.
Fucking hell.
Come on, Ray.
Anyway, but I would love to do it again, because I'd have a different attitude now. And I'd realise that you just got to let yourself go and enjoy it rather than, you know, taking it so seriously, which is what I did.
Do you like walking?
I love walking, because it's so great when it's done and you get back.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, it's just so lovely. It's lovely to walk like this. And you just, you're so, again, it's so present, and you notice things, and you can just let your mind wander, and freedom, and I love it. And you see this here, which is quite extraordinary. So we're looking at a post on a fence, wooden fence, and there's so much moss on it.
Oh my God.
And that means that there's no pollution here.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah, so you go down to Cornwall or Northumberland, you'll see it's everywhere, and in London you won't find it at all.
I'm interested that you're good at being on your own. I can see that. You're quite a self-sufficient person.
Yeah, I like, it's freedom.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got kids that are always like, mom, 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 mom. you know, and then you don't see them for ages, and you're so excited to see them, and they'll last for about 2 hours, and then, but, yeah, no, it's just because it is, it's, you know, it's busy.
Yeah.
And I do think, you know, I've often thought about, look back at my time with Trini and how absent we were, especially me with three kids. But my understanding now is that my children need me more now than they did then. You know, you could, a bit like my own childhood in a way. They were very secure, my kids. They knew this was home, and there was love, and we were doing the best we could. But I do much more for my kids now in terms of, not financially or organising their lives, but emotional support.
Come on, doggies. Come on. Come on,
Oh, look.
You're gorgeous.
Raymond, you can pretend you've walked the whole way
Raymond.
Now.
Raymond! Oh, you little...
He is quite sweet.
Susanna, I have loved chatting with you.
Oh, thank you. So have I. I've loved it.
Have you?
Yeah, it's been amazing. You've asked such good questions, and it's just been so natural. Do you know what I mean? It's like effortless.
Listen, we're going to say goodbye. Bye-bye!
Goodbye. Goodbye, Raymond. Oh, Raymond, I'm actually, I don't like other people's dogs, but I do quite like Raymond. I do quite like you because you're so little and so furry. And yes, you're so,
he really is very sweet. I really thought I wouldn't like him. I thought I'd want to kind of pray he got stuck down a rabbit hole or something. But I'm actually quite in love. I am quite in love with you, Raymond. And I don't like little toy dogs, but you are. Oh, he's just so lovely to hold, isn't he?
I really hope you enjoyed listening to that, and do remember to rate, review and subscribe on iTunes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.